Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and today we're going to be talking with Colorado rancher and mother of five, Laura Richardson, about her memoir, The Table, Seasons on a Colorado Ranch. In the book, she reveals the complexities of modern frontier life in the picturesque Rocky Mountain Valley, and shares seasons of growth and loss in her family and community while exploring stewardship of the land, body and soul, as she lays bare the deep moments of injury, mystery and death, while giving readers a glimpse to the daily demands and generous gifts of a livelihood that is becoming scarcer with each passing year. Laura Richardson is a former whitewater rafting guide on the Arkansas River. She lives with her husband and five kids on their family ranch in Salida, Colorado, where they raise over 300 Hereford mother cows and calves and grow over 30,000 bales of hay each summer. A voice for land stewardship, sustainable beef production, and family farm. She's a 2021 graduate of Western Colorado University's MFA program in nature writing. The Table is her first published work. So, Laura Richardson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you being on the program. Love the book here. This is, I guess, a starting point. This is a life that's becoming a little more rare these days.
It is, yes.
So tell me about the decision. Well, maybe before that, a decision to go out onto this ranch. Tell me a little bit about your life before before heading out to this ranch, living the life there.
Yes, my husband and I lived in Fort Collins, Colorado. He'd gone to CSU and I'd gone to UNC, and we were living there for a couple of years. He worked as a landscape architect in Fort Collins, and I was newly pregnant, and we were just kind of doing the, you know, life, the 9-to-5 life, and going to Salida on the weekends to visit his folks down here. And he was realizing that his dad was working really hard, but was retired from a job working for the government as a civil engineer, and was now ranching, and it was a lot of work. And he thought, maybe we should quit this 9-to-5 gig and go try our hand at ranching. So we did. We packed up our 3-month-old and headed to Salida.
Off you went. Yeah. So I understand you kind of mapped this out on a napkin sort of thing. What's the pros and cons, right?
We did. Yep. We went out to dessert one night and we said, well, should we do it? And so we did the typical pros and cons, and it seemed like just an exciting venture. We're young and thought, well, why not? We can always go back to a normal job, but we should try it.
So, your husband's fifth generation out on this ranch.
Yes. Not on this specific property, but just in Colorado in general. Yes.
So tell me about this ranch, this land. It sounds beautiful.
It is beautiful. Yeah, we're in a high mountain valley about 7,200 feet here in Salida, and we basically look out at Mount Shavano, the Collegiate Peaks range, bunch of 14ers, and we raise hay and we raise cattle, and it's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. The book is titled The Table.
Yes.
Tell me about this table. You talk about making this out of Engelmann spruce. Tell me a little bit about that process.
Yeah. So, we moved from the small little farmhouse that that we first started in when we moved here with one kid, and then we had four children there, and it was getting pretty small, and we didn't own it. It was just kind of on the ranch, and so we decided to build a house, and we brought in our little dining room table that was a hand-me-down table into this fairly big dining room, and we were like, that doesn't fit anymore. And so Andrew said, well, you know, I'll just build a table. And so he did. We actually were having youth group here, our church youth group, out on our front porch, and we didn't have a big enough table for all the kids. And so he just kind of one day threw together this rough cut lumber table out on the porch for all these kids to sit at. And then as the weather got colder and our normal table in our dining room was too small, he's like, well, let's bring it in. And so we did that, and that worked for about a week, but you can't wipe, you know, a rough cut lumber table. And so we're like, well, maybe we should sand it and stain it. And so that's sort of how it evolved into, it was on some sawhorses, you know, and then he's like, well, maybe I'll make a base for it. So it's been here for quite a few years now.
Seats 14, you say, without rubbing shoulders.
Yeah.
So and of course, this is a metaphor as well. I want to read a little bit from the early in the book. You say, I gather Christmas and think of how we all have our raw, rough edges. And when we meet and mingle our lives together like a garden harvest softening in broth, we are transformed at the table of life. So sharing stories, you know, holding hands, saying grace. Maybe expand a little bit about that. You see, and then a lot of the book is looking out from this table, right, out to the peaks and experiencing life as a family.
Yep, we can see the hay fields from our table and the cows grazing and the sunrises and sunsets. And so especially when, you know, our kids were younger and all at home, a lot of them are, you know, off on their own now. And so, but we would start each morning there with breakfast, kind of a requirement, I would say, for our family, you know, 7 o'clock breakfast, and you start the day together and, you know, get everybody out the door, off to school. But then at the end of the day, just coming back to that same place and learning about each other's day and what happened and how everybody's doing. And, you know, people are coming in with, you know, soccer cleats and shin guards thrown everywhere, or if it's summertime, you know, cowboy boots, and we've spent the day together working, or some people riding, some people on tractors. It just depends on what the day holds. But so you just come around, and there's usually not just our family at the table. There's always somebody else there, whether it's friends or other family, or so in like the summer we have a friend living with us working on the ranch, so he's here. And yeah, it's just a place to gather and be together.
Now, you did some research. You identified the first owners of the land you're on now, right? The Cameron family.
Yes.
1868, mm-hmm. You go back. I guess that's when they arrived.
Yes.
Tell me about the Camerons.
Well, they moved here when there was really very little here at all as far as infrastructure. Obviously no roads, no town of Salida, and so they were coming in to make a go of it. But if you think about 1868, I mean, that's, you know, Civil War era or post-Civil War era, and you know, Native Americans in this valley traveling through, lots of different tribes kind of warring with each other. And, you know, using this area as their home. And then you have people come in and make a permanent settlement here, and a stagecoach coming through, and it's a whole different world. No barbed wire fences, no grazing. It's just like the sky, right? Open. And
so, you know, modern technology, right? But I don't know, ranching life, you might be living a life a little more similar to the Camerons than, you know, a lot of us in the city are living to, compared to our ancestors.
Well, I'm sure if they saw us, they would laugh at that. But
yeah,
maybe we're a middle marker, right, between the cities and the Camerons. But yeah, sometimes we'll find really large draft horse shoes out in the field, you know, when we're plowing the field or whatever, and you just remember back to those times where everything they did was horse-drawn, even including, you know, digging ditches, miles of ditches up from Monarch Pass down here. It was all done with a team of horses. And even now, we have an easement on all of our ditches that we're allowed to walk through private property to maintain our ditches. And that amount of space that we have on either side is still written as enough to turn a team of horses around. Very different life, but also similar, you know, going by the seasons and, you know, producing a crop and raising animals and relying on family and neighbors. And so there are a lot of similarities, but a lot of differences too.
The Camerons were early in the valley, right? So you've inherited senior water rights. That's important.
Super important, especially in a year like this. We're in a pretty big drought with everybody, a lot of people. And so your year that your water rights came into being is basically puts you in a line of availability of water. So having senior rights, ours are very rarely do they get turned off, or what they call called, if your water rights are called. And so, yeah, we still have water running where a lot of people don't. We've had one year where our ditches turned off in 2002, and so we had no hay crop or no water that year. So Andrew did some other things to make money. So
Oh, I see. You had had to shift, and scramble. Yeah. Yeah. You write about how, through tragedy, through loss, through joy, a ranching life keeps you grounded. I guess literally, right? But also mostly because no matter what happened today, tomorrow you're going to have to get up and feed the cattle, and it's the same chores.
Yeah, it keeps you going. It makes you get up. There's things to be done that have to be done, because if you don't do them, there's going to be big problems.
Yeah.
So it does keep you in motion.
I think it's about maybe 1% of Americans live on farms, right? And you talk about how, therefore, most of us, 99% of us, are detached from our food sources. So what problems does that bring up, do you think?
Well, gosh, I think a lot of them. I think a lot of the food that we're buying and eating isn't that great for us, and so we can see that in our health problems and different things. But also, we get detached from the issues that surround food, and just if you sometimes your vote, you might think would be supporting something that's important to you, but then when you chisel it down to what that vote might actually be, you might be kind of might be a detrimental thing for just our food sources. And there's only a certain amount of land that we have to grow food, and so if we're dependent upon other countries for our food, I don't think those are the greatest choices.
I want to quote something you gave in another interview. You said, when people learn that Andrew and I raise beef cattle, there are mixed reactions. Some will ask us if we sell our beef, and if so, have any available. So that's one side. Can I get some of your beef, right? Others toss out a quick word about how our way with the beef is the main problem behind today's climate crisis. There is a debate there. What's what's your response if people accuse you of being part of the problem for climate?
Well, I think what's tricky is in the media, and then also some faulty just research has really displayed the US beef market as a big culprit in the problem with the climate at this time. And so I think people are pretty misinformed. I think if people really looked at actual accurate research, they would come to find that cattle actually are helpful in battling climate change. And there's some very bigger players who might be more of a problem. But as far as animals grazing and helping mitigate, forest fires with grazing down all the small fuels in the forest, as well as just keeping the soil more healthy. When you have comparisons between soil that's grazed and soil that's not, the health of the soil that's grazed is much better, as long as it's grazed well. You obviously have overgrazing that would be detrimental to the forest and the soils, but the Forest Service permit, allotment we have with the Forest Service, we have people who monitor our grazing of our cattle, and we ride with them, and we go and we look at different pastures that we're on, and we just are always moving cattle so that they're not overgrazing anything. And it's pretty awesome to see how effective it is. So
You've talked about how you're always trying to learn, always trying to innovate. That's important on a ranch. Tell me about that. What does any examples come to mind? Innovation.
Every year we're learning something new. For example, this year we're learning about we've had four animals die up on our Forest Service allotment this last couple of weeks. And we were trying to figure out if it was from lightning or, you know, there's a wolf who's real near our where our cattle are right now. And the Colorado Parks and Wildlife have been fantastic with us, sometimes calling, you know, throughout the day, hey, you know, he's over here, or last time we got, you know, information, he's here, and just wanted to let you know. So we were like, well, okay, well, maybe it was from a wolf. Or so as we did some more research, we're realizing it's from a larkspur flower that grows up high in this certain area of the forest. And our cows had just never been up into that area before. It's about 50,000 acres that we graze in the summer. And so just learning, like, wow, this beautiful flower looks like a delphinium, is completely toxic to cattle. And so just trying to figure out exactly where that's growing and keeping our cattle out of that area. And so, yeah, I feel like we're constantly learning every year. There's always something new.
Right? Mm-hmm. Farming and ranching's one of the more dangerous professions, you know, understand, you know, machinery, right? That you're, and farmers usually work on their own machinery, right? There's, you know, threshers and that kind of thing. And then I'm thinking of, you know, the animals themselves. There's a scene in the book where your husband has a cold. You're hearing the bulls. I don't know what they roar. Or, well, I don't know what bulls do. And Andrew says, oh, I forgot to feed them. So who's going to go, right? And then you mention, oh, they'll jump right over the fence, or they'll break right through it. They're the big, massive, powerful animals.
Yes. Oh, they completely are. And yeah, that's one of those things you talked about before, how the ranch kind of keeps you going in life, you know, and if you're having a hard time, it pulls you out of yourself, because you have to go feed things, and, you know, there's ditches flowing over, or hay that needs to be baled, or, you know, whatever. And so, yeah, that's one of those examples. And so those bulls are crazy big and crazy dangerous, and cows are unpredictable and horses are unpredictable. And, you know, when you're up riding and lightning strikes and your horses kind of freak out, it's like, okay, you got to be ready for anything. Or if there's a moose running through the forest, and, you know, the horses will hear them and see them long before we ever do.
So we're talking about dangers and some of the downsides, but and I'm sure there's upsides, you know, because you write with a lot of love about this lifestyle. What was it, what you thought it would be when you drew out the plans on that napkin?
Oh, so much more. It's amazing. It's incredible. I think it's, there's so many gifts that this place offers us every day. And, it was the most magical place to raise small kids and to have our kids grow up here. A lot of times, you know, they frequently will say, like, I can't believe we got to live up, you know, grow up like this. I think the more that they are, you know, in college and out in the world, they're like, wow, this is such a dreamy place to grow up and a dreamy place to come back to. And it's amazing, but a lot of hard work for sure. But I never thought we would be where we're at right now either, as far as, like, you know, we started out with 10 mother cows, and, you know, now we have 325 mother cows, and the calving season is a big deal. It's a pretty busy time, and haying, but it's fantastic. It's wonderful.
A lot of farmers live on, you know, pretty narrow margins. It sounds like you're doing well, but it can be economically challenging as well.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. It's every year it's a fine line trying to figure out how much to charge for, you know, for hay bales when you're selling small bales to people who are feeding horses. And then, you know, the cattle market is really up and down right now. It's really great. But some years it's not. And so we do have some, you know, we sell some custom beef of our own to people and have that processed. And then we also sell some of our animals to a business called Sun Prairie on the the Front Range in outside of Denver, and so they market grass-fed beef across the Front Range, and so we have different, you know, outlets for the beef. It's not necessarily all straight into the U.S. cattle market. So
I found that quote I was looking for, that about how life on the ranch grounds you. I want to read this. This is Laura Richardson writing in her book, The Table. When my life feels unstable and inconsistent, the ranch offers a gift. There is work that always must be done. The ranch requires us to leave our fragility behind for a time and focus on the job at hand. And ranch work usually demands a focused mind, giving reprieve from the things that can weigh me down. So that's, again, that's a blessing, right, from ranch life. You might have had a tragedy yesterday, but you got to get up and do it again tomorrow.
Yep. It's true. You got to get back on your horse.
Yeah. As as it were, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about encroaching land development. Already only 1% of people, you know, live and work on farms and ranches. And some areas, it sounds like in your area, some of this land is very attractive to developers. So you've probably had offers, right, for your land. How did you handle that? What did you decide?
Well, there's always people wanting to put, solar or, we've had hemp, just different offers that way. But definitely development has been happening around us a lot. A lot of the open spaces around us have been developed, as ranchers age or move or whatever. But we recently have had some changes in our county's, land use codes. And so they've sort of taken away, our development rights in a certain respect. We used to have different zoning, and now it's basically really changed. And so it's almost to the point where we couldn't really even apply for a conservation easement any longer, because those are based upon development potential, and the development potential of our ranch has just changed this year. So it's really challenging. So I think it's frustrating as a landowner to have other people dictate what you can do with your land. Our family is not looking to make a big subdivision out of the ranch or anything. The new generation is definitely exploring some different ideas of how they can jump in and, maybe down the road create some employment opportunities if they don't all necessarily want to ranch in the traditional manner. So trying to figure that out. But yeah, it's a little weird to just feel like all of a sudden we can't do what we want anymore, or maybe even not what we want, but we've just been given some much fewer options now. So
you mentioned the kids, and that's always a big decision. Is the next generation going to want this life, right? Your husband's fifth generation, right? What what do your kids think? Any of them gonna embrace this lifestyle?
They're all doing things other than ranching. They've all gone to college, and so we've got one of our daughters is a nurse. The other one is an investigator. One of our sons is in construction management in Northern Colorado. And then one's currently in school for engineering. But they've all voiced that they would like to one day come back and live here and maybe ranch or, whatever, see if they get their job in the big world, and then they realize, I kind of want to go back home and ranch, but I don't know if that's going to be an option, So Andrew's always said, make sure you have a job and an education and a career. And if the ranch is here for you later and you want to do that, that's great, but don't depend on it, because there's so many people involved. We have a really big family. And so we can't just say, oh, Abe, if you want to ranch, just come on back and you can run the whole thing, because the whole thing has a lot of people involved and a lot of opinions and needs. And so the future's, it's not set in stone that the kids will just take it over. Mm. So.
And then, taking a broader society, right? Many of us, you only have to go back one or two generations and you're on a farm, right? In my case, my mother was raised on a farm. Go out to visit grandpa on the farm. And so it's kind of in our psyche, right? But I don't know, do you obviously have people who blame you for the climate crisis, right? That kind of thing. But do you have people who you express jealousy that, hey, wish I had that lifestyle that you're living?
I guess I haven't really felt a lot of jealousy. It's just more when people come to visit, they just sort of are like, wow, I love this. Like, this is awesome. And just enjoy, I guess, being here. Well, maybe it's easy for me to say because I get to live here, but it's just so beautiful. It just sort of pulls you out of yourself, you know, in a way. It doesn't let you, I don't know. I just feel like it brings out the best in people, I guess, instead of the worst is my thought. It's just this beauty and peace and just energy and fun. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. So maybe that introspection isn't quite as much. And it's more just like, this is awesome. It's just enjoyment. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't felt that jealousy or animosity or anything like that. It's more just like, this is great.
Yeah. Of course, you know, a lot of these people haven't experienced what a January morning where you got to get up and, you know, go out and feed the cows in sub-zero temperatures, that kind of thing, right? Some downsides, I'm sure. But overall, a great lifestyle, sounds like. I wanted to conclude this part of the thing. We talked about development. You decided, of course, not to sell. I love this quote. In the end, we eventually concluded that at this point in our lives, we would only buy the life we already have. So you already live in the life you wanted, right? So
yes.
If you got the money, you know, that wouldn't be worth anything because you'd be giving up the life you already had.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, more with Laura Richardson. The book is The Table, Seasons on a Colorado Ranch, and that is out and available. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Laura Richardson, author of The Table, Seasons on a Colorado Ranch. And that is available, well worth a read, lovely read. And in the book, Laura Richardson talks about her life on this in a picturesque Rocky Mountain Valley, this ranch where she's raised her family, her husband, a fifth generation rancher. And you can find Laura Richardson at lauraruthrichardson.com. So I want to talk about your family. I want to start with your mother-in-law. You write very lovingly. Her name was Ruthie, right? Your husband's mother. It's kind of a force of nature, right? The matriarch of the family. You talk about importance of matriarchs or continuing traditions, glue that holds the family together. Tell me a bit about Ruthie.
Oh, Ruthie was amazing. She is a strong and powerful rancher's daughter, but also just the kindest, most loving woman, and funny and quirky, and loved ranching and just loved her family, her grandkids. She was that woman who just sat on the couch and read to kids, but always had food cooking in the kitchen and invited you over, and but always was wanting to get out on a walk and be outside, and she just was a very joyful and loving person to be around.
So you and your husband lived with her and your father-in-law, right, for a year and a half while Andrew, I guess, built or renovated the house you're going to live in. So you arrived with a newborn, right? And Ruthie took you under her wing. You talk about walks. She that was one thing that, and those continued luckily after you moved over, you know, a mile or two away. Tell me about that. She important for you to get out of the house, right? And you'd have these talks with her as you walked.
Yes, absolutely. I think she knew just as a new mother, you know, it's easy to feel lonely and isolated, and you know, your body's been ravaged by having a baby and nursing, and it's this whole shift. Plus, we, you know, just moved with a 3 week old baby, and so coming into a new community. And so she would just get me out each day on a walk, be like, let's go. Cause sometimes, you know, it's easy to get, you know, depressed or feel lonely, or, you know, your whole paradigm as a woman changes when you have a newborn. And so, yeah, so we would just get out there and walk up the hill together. And she'd just talk about things, share her own stories. She was really good about asking good questions and giving advice. And just, you know, she would pray while we would walk, which was sort of a new thing for me. And it became just a cherished time with her.
So. I love your description. I'm trying to remember it. You say she was good at trying to keep harmony. She was good at letting words directed at her in anger drop to the floor midway, right?
Yeah.
And you also say she was determined that the, you know, the family dinner was more than just a meal. Everybody gathered, and you left your animosities at the door.
Yeah. She grew up on a ranch over in Carbondale, Colorado, so on the other side of the Continental Divide from us, and had six siblings and a big ranch. And I think she saw how big families can, I don't know, just kind of be, people can be alienated, because when you have land and big opinions and things like that, it takes a lot to keep people together. You know, there's a lot of opinions and a lot of thoughts about how things should be done. Or, you know, when her parents passed away, what do you do with the ranch? And I think she really knew that you need to keep a family close together, because it can be torn apart pretty easily. I mean, it's hard enough to have a family, but then when you're working together and have land involved and animals and things like that, it's just important to come together and remind yourselves that you're family first, and that's really important.
You have a scene in the book where this struck me, where you're cooking a stew and you're using the old wooden spoon of Ruthie's mother's. So
yeah.
Two generations removed, you've kept, I guess it was handed down to you, and you're using this spoon. I guess that helps you connect with the generations.
Absolutely. Ruthie's mom, Ruth Perry, we called her, well, she was known as Diddy, but we called her Gammy. And yeah, she was just a wonderful rancher in Carbondale. And same thing, her kitchen, her home, her table was always welcome. Never just the people who lived there, who were staying there, were at the table. It was always somebody coming in and out and joining or stopping in. And just hospitality is a huge theme. I feel like on ranches, it's just this idea of having a home that's always open and extra terror always at the table, always having a little bit of extra food because you know that somebody's going to stop in. Yeah, it just seems to be just the pulse of a ranch home.
You talk about the rhythms of life, including death, right? I just want to read a couple of sentences from the table. Observing death is a gift to the living, in that it moves us past complacency into gratitude for another day. It is this loss that we are sanded and refined. It's connecting back to the table itself, right? Sanded it, brings out the grains of the wood. And then you say death adds a new weight to the natural things as it bids us to wake for every sunrise, linger in every sunset. When confronted with death, we become more alive. Out on the ranch, you're confronted with death, death of the animals, right? The death that we all experience in our lives as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, when Andrew's mom passed away from lung cancer, just that really impacted us. It makes you stop and think, you know, we all know we're going to die one day. That's the thing that we all have in common. And yet I think it's easy to go through our days forgetting that these days we have are numbered. And it's easy to let stress or just the distraction of the world and things and money and plans and I don't know. It's easy to get distracted from just being living a grateful life, a thankful life. We recently lost Andrew's dad to pancreatic cancer. And We got to walk through those last months with him, and it was incredible. It was just heart-wrenching and heartbreaking, but at the same time, it just makes you feel really alive. Like, wow, to watch somebody leave this world and then you're still here, it just makes you want to spend the days differently.
I want to have you talk a little bit about life. This is a Norwegian gentleman,
Yes.
one of the big characters in the book. Tell us how he got connected with your in-laws. He would come, I guess, for a month every winter.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think it's through skiing that he met Ruthie's mom and dad over in Carbondale. He was a big steamboat skier. His father, Carl Halvorsen, came over from Norway and brought the Nordic ski jumping over to Steamboat. So there's a big ski hill over there named after him. And so Ruthie's mom and dad were big skiers and had some roots in Oak Creek over there, and then skied in Steamboat, and so met life. Not exactly sure when and how their relationship evolved, but we met him when he was in his 90s. We were over there one winter in Carbondale, and he was staying there. And he would come and stay at their ranch for about a month each winter and write. And so we got to hear his stories and read a book that he wrote. And he's a pretty fantastic, jolly man, that's for sure.
And I guess that's how you pronounce life. A lot of us would pronounce it leaf, right? But life, and then it becomes a metaphor for life, right? In fact, you named one of your sons life.
Yes. And we spelled that one LIFE.
Right. Yeah. Did you have that in mind, right? Life. This son's going to be full of life.
Yeah. I think Andrew just loved remembering his grandfather in the mornings when life was there at the ranch, just coming down the stairs to the table where we're all sitting, and he'd say, "Good morning, life." And I think Andrew just loved that. And
Now, Leif, the Norwegian gentleman, he wrote a book you mentioned. He'd had this incredible experience where he was part of the resistance in Norway during World War II. He
Yes.
was betrayed by I guess, a coworker, and spent some time in a prison camp.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that. And then the shoe's on the other foot, right? They're freed, right? And then the guards become the prisoners.
Yep, for a couple of days, when he was in two different camps, I believe, and in the second one, the camp was finally liberated by the Allied forces. And so there were a couple of days where just the logistics of liberating a camp took some time. And so the prisoners became the guards, and the guards became the prisoners. And so, yeah, I can't imagine what those days were like.
Then Leif had an epiphany. He is full of rage, obviously, toward these guards. I just want to read something he wrote. "If you want to change the world, the best place is to start with yourself." And then he goes on to say, "When I learned to forgive, I became a free man." A profound lesson that I'm sure contributed
Absolutely.
to peace in his later life, right?
Yes. And it's just a powerful story. So I'm not sure. I don't know that my son necessarily tells that story every time when somebody says, "Where'd your name come from?" But I know he has told it before, and it's fun to have a story that comes with your name, you know?
Now, your son life has had some health problems, right? He's had some, as we all do,
Yes.
had some challenges in his life, right?
Yeah, he broke his leg when he was 8 years old. His femur shattered one day, and turns out he had a sort of a tumor in his femur that had made that bone eggshell thin. And so the day that it broke started a long road of six different surgeries on his. And the crazy thing was, this is last year, this last fall, he was helping somebody work on a car, and change the brakes on it, and they didn't have the tires blocked, and that vehicle actually landed on Life's femur,
Ooh.
the same one. So he
Oh.
broke it again.
Again,
So
wow. Yeah.
again, yes. So that was pretty awful. So he's got, another surgery on that leg. So.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with our last segment with Laura Richardson.
Thank you.
The book is The Table, Seasons on a Colorado Ranch. That book's out and available now. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Laura Richardson. Her memoir is The Table, Seasons on a Colorado Ranch. That's out and available now, and you can find Laura Richardson at lauraruthrichardson.com. So, Laura Richardson, I want to have you talk a little bit about your youngest child. This was, you adopted her, right? There was a gap after your it was a life, your youngest son, or Abe, I can't remember which one.
Yes.
And Esther is Navajo, Dene, right? Tell me how you came to adopt her.
Yeah, so our youngest child life was 10 years old, and my niece, who was 16 at the time, was pregnant and living down on the Navajo Nation, and she decided to move up to Salida to raise her baby, I think, in a different place. I think that her life there was a really challenging one. And so she was hoping to come up here and have a better life for her daughter. And so, her dad, who's my brother, lives here in Salida. And so she moved in with her dad, and, I got to help her with, kind of all the labor and delivery classes and prepare for this new baby to come, and just kind of walk through those months of pregnancy with her. And, yep. And then her little baby girl, Esther, was born, and life was 10. And so it was challenging. I mean, being 16 years old and coming from a pretty hard background, she was wanting to be a mom and wanting to raise Esther, but she soon realized that she wasn't ready yet. And so she got into some trouble, and so Andrew and I became Esther's kind of safety plan, created by the county. Just if for some reason something happened and Esther needs a place to go, we signed up as her home to go to. And so when that time came, when she was 6 weeks old, she came in the middle of the night with a couple of police officers and in a little car seat, and so began our life with Esther.
And she sounds like a beautiful child.
Yes.
Do you, I don't know, you kind of talk about this a bit in the book and navigate these issues. It can be controversial, right? Native adoption.
Yes, for sure. It was made very clear to us by the tribal attorney that their goal would be to have a Native family adopt Esther. And so that became the goal. And my sister-in-law, who lives on the Navajo Nation, she's awesome. She basically said to the tribal attorney, listen, our whole entire family down here would like Andrew and Lara to adopt Esther. None of us are in a place where we can adopt her. And so that would be our wish. And so because there were no other families down there who were, you know, applying or seeking to adopt Esther, and because we were blood relatives of her, we were able to adopt her, which was awesome. But it was kind of tense going there for a while. We didn't know. And then there was also trying to figure out Esther's birth father was, because he would also obviously have rights to have her. And so it was a long journey of not really knowing what was going to happen. So about a year and a half.
Yeah. How old is Esther now?
She'll be 10 this month.
10.
She
okay.
Just
yeah.
Fourth grade today. Yep.
That's mm-hmm. wonderful. Yeah. so I guess you and your husband will, you know, as she grows up, decide how and when to tell her about the background, right? And,
You know what, ever since she could talk and understand, we've told her that she's got a tummy mommy who is my niece, and then a forever mommy. And so she's got me, and she's got her birth mom who she knows and has met. And so she knows she's known she's been adopted ever since she can remember. And it's pretty obvious. I mean, you know, we're all of us have blonde hair and blue eyes, and Esther's beautiful Esther.
And, yeah.
But definitely.
Yeah. So. I'm sure you're thinking about how to navigate culture, right? She's living your culture now, but she has Navajo heritage, and as she gets older, how to navigate that.
Yes, for sure. We during COVID, we went down. It's really important for us to have her be officially registered with the Navajo Nation. And so my sister-in-law and my niece both met us there at the correct office. And, you know, we went in each individually with our masks on and signed all the correct papers and, you know, had to know the clan name and just all this paperwork. It was just amazing. But to have Esther be a registered member of the Navajo Nation was really important to us. And so, yeah, and we try to, you know, educate her about different things and to have that be a part of her life. And her Navajo family is pretty awesome about just encouraging her in that as well. So,
Just a couple of minutes left. I want to read that later in the book. You say this. I'll just read this and have you respond to it. You say, lately, there's this undercurrent flowing through my days, a consistent desire to linger in moments now before they become tomorrow's memories. Word is, I guess, getting a little older to produce that, but there are people who are aging a bit and don't have that, right? But where is this coming from, do you think, for you?
You know, it's interesting because now that I hear those words, I am in that place where our four older kids have all left home now. You know, they're all in their careers or in college. And so it's Andrew and Esther and me at the table. So we're sort of empty nesters with a fourth grader kind of, you know, and so it is just this, like, the sweet memory of this book. I feel like it was just kind of a gift to our family to remember those times when we were all here together. And it's so special when everybody comes home now. You know, and we are all around the table. It's just like kind of those good old times. But definitely you know, I guess I just really wanted to encourage people to, when you're in those moments with your family, your loved ones, your friends, to truly just, like, don't forget to stop and look around and remember and just enjoy those moments, because they don't last forever, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it's easy for us to take people and things for granted. And so just to try and enjoy those days and let there be a little bit of weight to your moments of, you know, connecting with people and the people who you love and just making special times, because they don't last forever and life moves on. And that's what we want for our kids, you know, is to grow up and move on and be successful and have families of their own and things like that. And so you think it's going to last forever, especially when you have little kids. You're like, wow, this is a lot. But then they do end up growing up and moving on.
Yeah, they certainly do. Just about a minute mm-hmm. left. I want to talk about the, you know, writing it down. So MFA program wrote this memoir, right? So that's a treasure for you and your family. And mm-hmm. you know, it's out and available for all of us to read as well. You talk, there's a passage in the book, a couple of passages where you talk about your husband journaling, right?
Yes.
Maybe just, 30 seconds on the importance of writing things down.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every day, we journal and, write about the day before, have a list for the current day. It's just easy to forget. And boy, we're feeling that the older we get, you know, it's like, what did we do yesterday? You know, kind of thing. And, but it's really special to go back and read. And, on our anniversary, we'll sometimes take our journals and just go and be like, hey, flip to, you know, April 4th. What'd you write for that day? You mm-hmm. know, and it's so funny to see the different perspectives of what a day can hold.
That sounds like a great tradition on your anniversary. You open your journals together. Yeah. Well, we've reached the end of our time here. Laura Richardson has written a wonderful book. It's called The Table, Seasons on a Colorado Ranch. That's out and available now. Thank you so much for the conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.